I was going to begin with something I was thinking about this week. I really was blessed last week by Floyd's comments about chapters 8 and 9 paralleling Daniel 11, and that they represent, you can say philosophically or theologically or politically even, the two streams of consciousness that run through history. Hedonism versus Babylonian law and order. I got to thinking about a third way, and I thought that was kind of cool until I started questioning, is that really being used? Is it used for something that I wouldn't want to be associated with? So I looked it up online, and sure enough, the third way in Germany refers to neo-Nazism. And in America, the third way is an amalgamation of, you might say, the Democrats and the Republicans. So socialism and socialism and capitalism combined, or something like that. And I was like, too bad. Can't use that term to describe what I believe. So I wanted to point that out lest we go there. But I was really blessed by that, and I just hope that that we find more about that as we move on, because I think that it's there in Revelation. The other thing I found was an article, and I don't have it at my fingertips, so I'm going to have to go do this by memory. An article written by someone who suggested that Jesus, when he dealt with the law, or when he dealt with the Old Testament and Judaism, took his hearers away from law into a higher dimension. And he didn't spell that out. I didn't have time to read it. But I really feel that that is exactly the way I went. I recently wrote an, or I should say a year ago, last summer, I wrote an article for a fest trip for Alden Thompson that was on how Jesus read the Old Testament. And I came to that real conclusion at the end of it. And I only looked at Matthew 5. That was all the time and space I had to deal with. So I see Jesus as doing a new hermeneutic, you might say. And I came to the conclusion that hermeneutic was love. And that was, I mean, it was an awesome article to write because I didn't know really where I was going for sure. I was just following the text and allowing the Holy Spirit to influence me. And I came away right away to this belief that it's more than just a hermeneutic principle. It is the ability to look in my heart, to see internally all Jesus claims about getting adultery is sinning in your heart, and all of these things. It has to do with the heart life. And then at the very end, it came to me very clearly that his hermeneutic was love. So I just wanted to share that, and then we can go on to Revelation. Is it Revelation 9 that we are on now?
That we're still in, yeah.
That we're still in, yeah. And
It's
I
been
can't remember
16.
which verse we quit on.
Floyd, you listened to this most recently.
Well, I don't remember. We remember the bottomless pit, but I'm not sure we finished that, did we? So we didn't really come to get to the locusts.
Yeah, I think we could stand to read the sixth angel, or was it even before that?
Well, I don't remember us talking
Oh,
about the
seven.
locusts, and
You're
that's
right.
in Angel 5.
There were a lot of things in here that we didn't even touch.
Okay.
We sort of picked and choose the cream stuff, and
Yeah,
there
we
was a
kind of did
lot
an
of stuff left
overview.
laying around.
And there was quite a bit of bouncing,
Okay.
Right.
in this. And I remember Bill speaking on his thought on what that vision about the locusts were and the kind of the war aspect of it. And I have heard that before, but yeah, it's my recollection in it.
Yeah.
You know, your first point about the third alternative being sort of an amalgamation of the two extremes is very often the only solution that people think they have to that's possible.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
over the last several years of just soaking in revelation, it's becoming more and more clear to me that that's what this whole book is about. It's not just a third option, which is actually carefully crafted to deceive us. It's the analogy for me is like playing on a teeter-totter, and you think, well, the solution is let's all come to the center, and then you won't have these extreme ups and downs. That looks like the only option is, and when I look at this book, it's like, no, get off the teeter-totter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you're playing the wrong game entirely. You will never arrive at an effective, because it's even how we define victory. It's how we define solution. It's how we define the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Our definitions are the core problems.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we win wars in this world by having either more strategy or more force.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm reading here is, no, the war is over what weapons you use, what strategy you use, how you define mm-hmm. victory. Everything is being it's being born again into a whole new dimension, whole new perception of reality. It's so radical. I don't even think we're beginning to see how radical it is.
Right.
And yet that's what I see emerging out of Revelation is like the hero of this book gets introduced in chapter 5 as violently slaughtered. Well, that just totally blows victory out of the water. How in the world can you win that way?
Mm-hmm.
It never has made sense to me until recent years when I began realizing that the words we use are even part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because almost every word has been hijacked. And until we realize that and we go back and redefine the words based on the Lamb's perspective instead of the flesh, you know, our interpretations are messed up because we're interpreting it according to the flesh.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you fight against somebody who doesn't fight back?
Mm. Yeah.
So fighting and war and violence and victory. Those are alien terms
mm-hmm.
to the Lamb.
And they're all mm-hmm. designed to achieve control.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And Jesus is not about gaining control. You have to redefine what the real problem is, which is difficult to swallow. But once you get the right diagnosis, it's like, well, then the remedy for that is can't even be close to what we've been thinking you have to do.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, so which verse do we start with?
I was going to kind of follow on what Floyd said there, is that you can argue back and forth about the answer, but if you're trying to solve the wrong problem,
mm-hmm.
none of that is going to matter. And
right.
to me, that's where the enemy really has won the day. He's won the messaging thing by getting us all to assume that winning the war is the problem we're trying to solve, instead of restoring trust. You know, and if God is all about love, then how can you love somebody you don't, well, I guess you can love somebody you don't trust, but you can't really have a good love relationship unless it's based on trust.
Mm-hmm.
So until we recognize that that's the problem rather than beating our enemy, no matter what we do, we're going to come up with the wrong solution.
Yeah. That's well put. So what verse are we ready to start, or do we want to still talk about this?
I think we should read 1 through 6 again.
Okay.
Because we haven't even talked about some of the stuff in 1.
Well, when we're thinking about these things, we're all thinking about the solutions we're seeking are all rooted in the principle of selfishness.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Satan's principle.
Mm-hmm.
And until we realize that that's the losing principle, and it's his principle, and that God's principle is unselfishness, we're lost as a goose.
Okay, so since Bill read verses 1 through 9 last time, I'm going to ask Nancy, would you read verses 1 through 9 this time, please?
Revelation 8 or Revelation 9? Sorry.
Revelation 9, 1 through 8.
Was it 1 through 6 or 1 through 9?
1 through 9.
Okay.
Okay. And I'll be reading from Free Bible Version and hope to do as well as Bill always does. I love your dramaticness. I love it. The fifth angel blew his trumpet. I watched a star fall from heaven to earth. The star was given the key to the opening of the abyss. He opened the entrance to the abyss, and smoke came up out of the abyss like the smoke of a huge furnace. The sun and the atmosphere became dark because of the smoke from the abyss. Locusts came out of the smoke onto the earth, and they were given power like that possessed by scorpions. They were told not to harm the grass or any vegetation or any trees, only those who did not have the seal of God on their forehead. They were not allowed to kill, but they could torture these people for 5 months. The torture was like that of a scorpion when it stings someone. During that time, people who look for death but won't find it, they will want to die, but death will run away from them. Locusts looked like war horses. They wore what seemed to be golden crowns on their heads, and their faces looked human. They had long hair like women, and they had teeth like lions. Their breastplates looked like they were made of iron, and the noise made by their wings sounded like many horses and chariots racing into battle.
Okay, I do remember that we did talk quite a bit about the bottomless pit. We did get through that. So I don't know if we should just recap that, or do we want to go through that again?
Well, how did he get the key? And what is the key anyway?
Was this still the idea that, like, authority was given, that the givenness is due to role or rebellion? You know, so if this is describing the Lucifer, the adversary, Satan, given his role, his rebellion, is that just a given that he has the key to this?
That's kind of what we thought last week. But I'm trying to remember a verse. Doesn't Jesus talk about giving the keys to the church?
Mm.
And whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven. I'm thinking of the general context of those keys.
And I think that's a huge part of this that I haven't really fully explored that, but there is enormous potential for understanding the very idea of key in scripture. And yes, it has to do with authority, but why is it specifically identified in certain places as a key?
Well, a key opens.
Okay.
And a knock can open as well.
Hmm.
Well, given that God is the God of freedom, Satan had that option to open up this whole distortion of God's character and temptation, and to get beings to side on his side, which created all kinds of havoc, both in heaven and then later on earth. So I was wondering if he had something to do with choice. Because God does give each of us the choice to make decisions about what we're going to do with our freedom.
And the thought came to me as you were talking, Nancy, that in Job, Satan asks, or basically doesn't really ask. He presents Job as someone who needs to be tested. And I'm putting that too blandly.
He declares that Job is not what God says he is.
Yeah. And thus said, if you reach out your hand and touch all that he has, he will curse you to your face. If you, and God responds, he is in your hand.
But then on the second round, God says, you provoked me to do it to him.
He says, you incited me against him without cause.
Yeah. You're like, wait, what's going on here? I thought you were on my side.
I always see this as a hot potato thing with God and Satan passing Job back and forth. Mm-hmm. And finally, the narrator ends it with saying, so Satan went out and struck Job with sores from the sole of his feet to the top of his head.
You know, that's not Satan. That much different from the heated dialogue that Moses had with God. And God saying, get out of my way so I can go kill all these people, make you a great nation. Isn't he handing Moses a key? And Moses turning around says, oh, no, you don't. You're not doing that. You'll ruin your reputation.
Yeah. But they see Moses isn't Satan there.
That's right.
That's the difference.
I love it.
Yes. But the dialogue is strikingly parallel.
Well, he's certainly testing Job Moses, because, you know, it always has struck me as kind of almost tongue in cheek when he says, mm-hmm. step aside so I can get angry and destroy these people, mm-hmm. as though God couldn't get angry with Moses standing in front of him.
Good point.
Well, and to me, there's a stark contrast between Satan's coming to pick a fight with God. He's using fighting language. He's got a mission. He's the father of all life, a murderer from the beginning. Came to steal, kill, and destroy, and he's come to pick a fight. Well, let's listen to him.
Yeah, and if you extend that further, Satan is intending that God give him planet Earth. There's a property issue hidden in the text. And it's not overt. A lot of scholars miss it. But when Satan says, when God says, where have you come from? It's not a friendly question, like some scholars would like to think. Most scholars think that Satan is God's right arm of punishment, which is a very old view.
Mm-hmm.
Not a scholarly view, in my opinion. So Satan says to God, from going to and fro upon the earth and from walking up and down upon it, that's property issue right there. He's taking out his claim on planet Earth.
And God says,
oh, well, now have you considered my servant Job, that mm-hmm. he's an upright and righteous man?
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, I have somebody down there. And why isn't he up here instead of you?
Well, and the funny thing is, question he knows the answer to ahead of time. I mean,
God doesn't know.
So, like, he's asking, so where have you come from? This is an opportunity for you to tell the truth here. You got to do it? Because I already know where you've come from.
Right, he does. But God uses his power of knowledge to override anybody.
Yeah. And in that thought, Gene, that's a good thought, because bringing it back to Revelations 9:1, and thinking about this word key, and I'm looking at it as like entrusted or trusting. For example, if you give someone a key to your home, you trust them. If you give your daughter or your son the key to the car, you trust them. Is this a way of saying, I give you this key to this pit, in trusting not Hasatan, but in trusting in his purpose going forward or his plan?
The problem with that, I think, is that the pit goes way back to Genesis 1, the abyss, the deep, sometimes translated the deep, and that is Tehom. And that anciently, in ancient Near Eastern understanding, and this goes all the way through Revelation, yes, Tehom is the epitome of evil and chaos. And it's equated with darkness. Darkness covers the deep. So there's this very strong imagery that runs through the Bible. And Leviathan lies in the deep. And Leviathan is the dragon of Revelation. That's where John gets his imagery for the dragon, is Leviathan. And the beast, Behemoth, is the beast of Revelation. So he gets those two imageries from Job 40 and 41. Otherwise, you know, I would go for that. And certainly God does have a purpose moving forward with what's happening. But it seems here that...
How about this thought about the key?
The smoke, see, the star that falls from heaven that's equated with this pit is clearly Satan. Mm-hmm. Because the star in the Bible represents angels.
All right.
So clearly it's Satan who falls, and the key is given to him. The key's given to the star.
And it's not identified as who it comes from either.
No.
Now, could that key be his principle, which actually produces all the chaos that comes from the pit?
Are we the chaos pit prior to creation?
Well, no, it's the principle. You don't have to have the chaos there. The principle will create chaos.
Oh, that's true.
Selfishness will create chaos, and from the pit comes all the stuff that's chaos, and it's part of this principle.
So by the way, Mark has his hand up as well.
Go ahead, Mark.
Oh, you caught me going up a hill, so I'm not dying of a heart attack, but it occurs to me back on this question of the key. A key is used to secure something, to lock it away. And it's not an accidental act. It's a very intentional act to lock something away. So we can't suppose that whatever it is that's being released was put there by accident. It was purposely put there and locked and secure and intentionally locked away. And now for whatever reason, it can be released. I don't think that makes things better. I think it makes it worse in my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an important principle to me that whatever it is that was being released was not put there by accident.
Right.
And I think what was put there is identified in Jude and First Peter or Second Peter, I don't know which one it was, where it says that the angels who left their first estate are in chains of darkness, which I think is linked to the pit. And if you look at the description here, and Mark makes a really good point that when he has permission from the key to open that pit is where these forces of evil have been restrained and locked away as described by Peter and Jude. And they are temporarily released. And this passage is in stark contrast to Revelation 20, when an angel comes down, or is it 19? I can't remember which one it is. Where
20, he gives the key to the abyss to release.
Right. But he is now locked away. So it's the reverse of what's happening here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's no accident that they're the polar opposite. So the one who now has the key and releases everything out of the abyss is then put back into the abyss and locked back up again.
Gina, I found something. I knew it was in the 3-7 churches somewhere. Message to Philadelphia. He who is holy, he who is true, who has the key of David, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens, says this. I know your deeds. Behold, I have put before you an open door, which no one can shut, because you have a little power and have kept my word and have not denied my name. This is the Church of Philadelphia.
That's a call back to Isaiah 22. I'll give him the key of the house of David. What he opens, nobody can shut. What he shuts, nobody can open.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in Revelation.
Revelation 3.
Okay.
It's actually verse 8. Well, verse 7 and verse 8.
I think this idea of the key and shutting and opening is, I don't know, for me, it's probably the one of the most vague, misunderstood teachings around. It's just not clearly taught. It's not clearly, thoroughly studied out. It's just vague. It really is vague most of the time when it's talked about.
I noticed that the commentator that I've been using, Ranko Stevanovich, neatly leaves it out.
Well, is it still the assumption that, I mean, not only is the star who's fallen Satan, the adversary, the actions are coming from the destroyer, the adversary? I mean, is that, I just want to.
I think that's clear. I think we can definitely say that. But the role of the key is a bit more difficult.
Okay.
Because a key of a bottomless pit, a pit without a bottom, is not a pit, really. It's a liminal space into something disastrous or something. It's very difficult to think about a bottomless pit.
Well, so here's just a random thought. And I guess it doesn't necessarily work on a timeline kind of basis, but the illustration is there was a cosmic conflict over the character nature of God. And in order to play this out, there was, in essence, a backwater area of the universe. And it's like, okay, you're limited to this. This is the abyss of the universe. And then God demonstrates his goodness and love through a creative process, setting a counter to the chaos that is wherever the adversary is. I don't know. Is that within the realm of metaphor and possibility?
Well, I think it has a lot of credibility. I think the key keeps moving around and showing up in different places, in different hands.
Well, it can be used. The key is not always the key to the same lock.
Mm-hmm.
I think the key to the Philadelphians was to something very positive. Yeah. But the key to the shaft of the abyss is something very negative.
In chapter one.
So without defining that, like, not to get too deep about this abyss, because we can't. Can we agree that at least we know what is opening could be something similar to a metaphor like Pandora's box? That whatever's coming out of this, as we can see in verse 2, is coming out like smoke out of the pit. Now, that gives me presence of mind to think about smoke in two ways. I think of smoke more like as a nuisance in Father's nose. In other words, this is not, we know from where we were at, that this is going to come out. This is, nothing good is coming out of this at this time. I mean, again, it specifically states like the smoke from a burning furnace.
It's like smoke from a burning furnace, from a huge furnace.
like, yes.
But you can cross-reference that with Revelation 14. The smoke of their torment or painful mm-hmm. suffering. How can suffering smoke?
Hmm.
It's not smoke from the fire that's burning them. It's smoke from their suffering, unless that's assumed to be the torment by fire.
And that's very parallel to how the description of Mount Sinai was. Smoke as of a furnace.
And he suffered the pain of fire and sulfur, and the smoke of their painful suffering. Does sulfur smoke? Does anybody know anything about sulfur?
Burning sulfur, I think, creates a lot of smoke.
It's a yellow smoke.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's
a majority
apparently tied to the sulfur smoke.
Yeah, it's a majority component to a flare. And if you ever lit one of those and smelled the discharge from that smoke, it's pungent. It's tough.
Okay.
So there's three hands that have popped up. Mark was first, then Nancy, and then Ken.
Okay. I should know better than to raise my hand before I go up the hill. without going into all the details of what each individual thing means, it seems clear to me, and this is kind of a question, but can we agree that this comes just before the end and releasing it is not a good thing at all? And as to the smoke, I was thinking, oh, so what smoke? Well, it can be incense, but also one of the signs of battle is a column of smoke over a city that's being built and or burned. And it occurs to me that my understanding of the war in heaven was that when they were cast out, they were kind of cast out into this abyss. And that when it's opened up, that war in heaven just picks up where it left off.
My thought doesn't talk about that, but when we're talking about what Satan opens up, like you said, there's some ability he has to get this stuff out. And he's living up to his name in, which we haven't read yet, but verse 11, where he's referenced specifically as the destroyer, he brings destruction. And all these things that are unleashed are counter to life. When you think about smoke, the thing that kills people in fires is smoke inhalation. And it also blackens and darkens things so you can't see. You know, and it goes on to say that he has these unique creatures, and their intent is not normally what locusts do, eat vegetation. No, this is to specifically target and torture, individuals. So it's really, really dark what he's up to and just living up to his name as destroyer.
Well, the thought I was thinking about smoke is smoke obscures vision and you can't see clearly through it. Mm-hmm. So that's just a random thought.
Well, that's not random. That's actually what the text says.
Okay.
The text specifically identifies that this smoke obscures the sun.
Yeah.
That is a major point. That's a major point of what's being emphasized here, is that it's hiding the light of the sun.
And this would be a metaphor for the gospel or the good news or the reality of who God is.
Well, if that's what it is, it's the principle of selfishness that obscures it, which has been woven into the common gospel.
Mm. I think a key clue here is where it talks about the tails of the scorpions. You know, this amalgamated grasshopper creature, scorpion slash, everything else, which obviously is not a creature. It's a metaphoric description of an amalgamated spiritual complexity. And someone pointed out to me one time, and I've looked all through, and there's only one verse that I know of in scripture that specifically identifies the prophetic meaning of a tail. and it says that the head is, I think, the elders, you know, the abuse of power, and the tail are the prophets who speak lies. And that parallels perfectly with this, because the smoke that's obscuring the light, which represents truth, and these creatures that distill out of the smoke, there it keeps emphasizing their tails. It says their powers in their tails, the powers in their tails. They have a sting.
They're telling lies.
Well, it's it's the lies. Well, they distilled out of the lies, and they're producing lies, and they're the purveyor of lies. So this entire prophecy is couched in the atmosphere of various metaphors that are all talking about lies.
That works, I think.
I like that thought.
Also, the key part, that I think how the key plays into this is because the way permission works in the war is that one side or the other in this war, in the supernatural realm, receive permission from the people. And I know that I've read some things that were in books that were clearly and openly said to channel the communications of the forces of darkness into the books. I mean, they were literally channeled books, and they're quite well known. And they said, or Satan said in those books, that their plans were to externalize their presence on Earth. And clearly by how it was worded, they needed the cooperation of humanity.
Right.
And the statement they said was they were surprised at how much cooperation they were getting much sooner than they had planned on. And so therefore they were accelerating their plans to externalize and take control of humanity because they were getting so much cooperation, in essence. To me, that is parallels what it says. They were given the key. We are giving them the key. Humanity is giving them. So many people are giving their will over to the forces of darkness in one way or another, and they're taking it. They're taking this authority and immediately implementing their strategies and actually speeding them up because so many people are so willing to go along with them.
Oh, yeah, that's why I said in the earlier that the Father is allowing it, because he cannot come between that. You know, if we look at it from a war standpoint, not to get tactical, it's a highly fluid circumstance, very, very fluid.
The way God runs his universe is built on freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And
choice.
So if we give Satan permission, he does take over. Mm-hmm. And we can give him permission by simply agreeing to his lies about God. Exactly.
Can I dovetail on that with some of the other words open? You know, it's interesting, in Revelation, many things are opened. Mm-hmm. Heaven is open. Books, doors, now the abyss, scrolls. What is that about? Could it be that these things, these lies we're talking about that Satan has opened, are there to darken our minds and to keep our hearts from opening and responding? Because our hearts can either open or close to respond to God's character, as we're talking about, or we can be closed to it. So I think the human heart is kind of like the pit in a way.
Working on that a little bit in my mind is the level, heaven is open, the books are open. This is God being transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And that the abyss being opened is a requirement of transparency and therefore evidence of freedom. Mm-hmm. And then that authority, which dovetails with what Floyd has been saying, is we give our allegiance regardless. This is our choice to bear. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And under one, the given of, if you will, giving authority to God is the most freeing because he's promised self-control. Giving authority to the adversary, we are surrendering all forms of freedom in order to be a slave.
Right.
And I think that's what, to me, Revelation is bearing this out, and that the destroyer's mechanism is destructive. I mean, so the adversary's MO, there's nothing that can come from. He's not light. He's not life. The only thing that can flow is death and destruction. Whereas giving our authority, giving the key to God, is to receive the fullness of freedom back. Mm-hmm. And I see that playing out. So I just heard that from everybody. And I saw mm-hmm. Mark wanted to say something as well. Sorry, I jumped on you, Mark, there.
Because basically, do we have any idea of where in the eschatology timeline this opening of the pit comes? Because it sounds to me like it's, okay, all questions are answered, and now the opening of the pit, to me, signals the final release of Satan for the last battle. Is that counterindicated by something?
You mean if you take it the way historically we have?
Well, no, I'm commenting on the fact that if this is the final release of Satan and his cohorts, that has to come after everything that God needed to protect has been protected. And there's no more point in holding them there, because God would not release them if there was any reason that anybody would be unsafe not to do it. I mangled that sentence, but I think you understand what I mean.
Yeah. The idea of probationary processing.
Well, not exactly that, although I think that the probationary period is related in that the probation closes when there is no more point in keeping it open. Mm-hmm. And I think that would probably be synchronous with God saying, okay, there's no more point in keeping probation open, and there's no more point in holding back the forces of Satan. We let them go for the last demonstration of this is what evil is really all about.
I think it's interesting to note, Mark, in response to that, that this is the first woe out. And then the sixth, when we get to the sixth trumpet, then that's where they release the four angels that are being tied up at the great river Euphrates. So it's interesting to me. God's still up to something even before this. You know, I like to look at it that, you know, and I'll try to see where all of this fits in the great plan that God has. But anyway, it looks like there's more yet to come, and the release of the four winds at least is mentioned in the next trumpet, not this one, even though this sounds, it's hard to imagine something worse than what's being described. But
I see throughout.
Are we absolutely certain that these are sequential timeline things?
We haven't been attempting to. We occasionally bring it up. So it's not forbidden, but it's just we haven't
set the timeline in stone. Or whatever it is, the blue stone.
One thing I think would be hard to argue is that they jump around and go backwards, or they're absolutely mm-hmm. not connected at all to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I think mm-hmm. each set of sevens is progressive within itself. I also mm-hmm. think that the three or four sets of sevens have a lot of overlap because they parallel so much. I see a progressive releasing on both sides. You know, so the lamb pops seals and things are released, 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 released. Now we get into the trumpets, things are being released, released, released. Mm-hmm. The very act of pouring out bowls is releasing.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a releasing of truth and light and love, and there's a releasing of increasingly releasing of darkness. So I don't think there is a single point or suddenly God's withholding everything and then everything breaks loose. I think these are like wave after wave after wave of release and counter release and release. And each time the intensity keeps getting greater and greater and greater.
Yeah. If you look at the next verse, you're going to see there's a stipulation regarding how far they can go.
Yeah.
So this war, which is a war, it seems to be moving from a overt type of war to a covert type of war. This is a war of hearts now coming into play.
It's interesting to go ahead, William.
That's okay. I haven't studied this. This is my first time going through with, you know, openly with people. So I'm looking at it from a standpoint of not hurting the grass of the earth. That might give you all a better clue as to this, where it fits in the whole blessing of the, you know, of the revelation. I don't know. But the fact that we have seals on the head, to me, my way of looking at it is, okay, there's God, there's myself, and there's these people that are here that have a seal on their forehead. It's just the way I'm looking at it. It's probably very limited thought. I'll just put it like that.
Go ahead, Nancy.
I think it's interesting just to see how God is always up to saving. God doesn't want anybody to be lost. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, we've just been reading about what I think is the identification of Satan with all these thirds, but there's this limitation from one third, you know, from a fourth. Now we're up to a third. And there's this continued progression of releasing the powers of darkness. And I appreciate, Floyd, what you were saying about who's participating in this, that's accentuating those waves. But I would encourage everybody to listen to Siegfried Tonstad. Brad and I were listening to the kind of typical Adventist historicist view, and then kind of the upgrades that have happened from Uriah Smith to, he'd mentioned a couple other, Rondell, and there was another one you mentioned earlier. And I really appreciated his shifting that around for me to kind of go towards, have we been trying to fill shoes that are too small and not really say much about God's character? And he says the focus on historicism has been historical events. But Uriah Smith was, you know, talking about the Huns and the barbarians that invaded, and then some of the other views identified some of new thought developments after the fall of Jerusalem and the fall of Rome. And anyway, it was all kind of new to me. But I love Siegfried Tonstad saying the cosmic conflict is centered on the reality, and the theology is really the revelation of the character of God. And it switches from the typical historicist view has been a retributive God, which is not good news. And the focus is on Christ and how he reveals the character of God. And it's a much more open and comprehensive view, instead of trying to, as historicists have, try to link, well, this trumpet's related to when these people did this. Anyway, it was very refreshing.
So he likes the cosmic conflict interpretation rather than historicists.
Yes.
I hope that kind of made sense. I don't know if it did, but.
Well, I think it fits a whole lot better.
Well,
A lot of these things remind me of, I'm trying to work on writing The Great Controversy as a story. One of the writing things is that you create a bunch of scene cards or a storyboard, and it's a lot of, well, this might happen, this might happen, this might happen. If time is nonlinear, as I believe it to be, if the prophet is showing a bunch of things that happen, he might not also have been shown the exact order in which they are. In fact, that might actually still be indeterminate. So he has no choice but to put them in some order. And I'm inclined to think that maybe we shouldn't overtax ourselves by the order he chose to put things in, because he may have been doing the best he could. It's like the
Ezekiel saw the wheel, you know. He was shown something fantastic, but didn't really know how to describe it. And I think we might be seeing some of that same thing here.
I could say that the prophets are not chronological.
Mm-hmm.
They have things all over the place. And that has always kept me from becoming an expert in the prophets because I like coherence. But the prophets just get a vision here and they put things down, and then they get a vision over here and they put things down. And so if you read like the book of Isaiah, you're not going to find a timeline. You're not going to find a developmental pattern as much. You might find a lot of chiasm, but that's usually within a text, not as a whole. I wanted to point out something. This is a minor thing, but these are cues. Revelation has this locust that acts and looks like a scorpion. It's possibly in a kind of Babylonian amalgamation. Babylonians loved mixtures.
Mm.
And so they'd have the lion man and the eagle, not eagle, but the fish man and so on. They'd have all these, what they called, what they used as protective spirits. They had all these amalgamated creatures. And I think that might lie behind Babel, as in Babylon, in Genesis 11, tied to the Hebrew word balal, which means confusion. And we've always seen Babylon as representing confusion, and that to me was not helpful. but rather mixtures, mixing things that don't belong together, a very arbitrary thing to do. And it undergirds the thinking of the Babylonians. And the reason I bring this up is because it dawned on me that these cues are here because Babylon's coming up. Mm. And Babylon has a major role to play in Revelation. So you're going to find all kinds of kind of Babylonian type things in Revelation until you get to Babylon.
That's interesting.
I've been noticing this for years as I read Revelation. I said, oh, that reminds me of this in Babylonian culture and so on. It's been kind of interesting. And someday I'm going to sit down with Revelation and map those out. But right now they're just, as I see them, I think about that. So this was something I saw and thought, Yeah, mixtures.
When you mix things together that are not supposed to be together, the substance is adulterated. Mm-hmm. We get adultery and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what that your comments brought to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was thinking the hitting of the wine, the unmixed.
Unmixed.
Considering to be like that with
or fornication. The fornication is the opposite of the mixture, unmixed.
Yep. Wine. Yep.
And the fornication is with kings. It means a religion becoming fornicated with power and politics and kingship and hierarchy.
Mm.
Yeah.
As I was looking over this chapter again, or this fifth trumpet, I noticed a literary pattern that might be helpful for giving maybe of some structure or outline. The first verse says that the key was given to him. And then it describes what happens when the abyss is open. Then the same idea is repeated when it says power was given to them, which is very parallel to the key being given to them. And then it describes, you know, the outcome of this power, the limitations on the power. And then the rest it seemingly the rest of this trumpet describes the nuances and the details of what they have and what they're capable of doing and what they can't do and what they look like. The stuff that drives us crazy on this one is all fill in after these two givens. The key is given. It describes a little bit what that's about. And then it says power is given. And then it describes that. And then it describes who they are. Whatever that means.
I remember a talk by, I think it was Dr. Bull, where he talked about in the ancient world, and I think that would include the New Testament writers, but there were only two actors. Either man did it or God did it. So if they receive this key, then God must have done it in that way of thinking. Now, we, of course, have some other things. We have natural consequences. We have random acts. And but I think maybe that would help us if we understood the world the way the writer saw this, and that might modify how we saw the giving of this key.
You know, it also occurred to me, just as I'm thinking about it, in chapter one, Jesus declares unequivocally that he has the keys of death and the grave. Mm-hmm. Here, the keys are given and the description involves death. In chapter 19 or 20, the key is used to lock Satan for 1,000 years in the pit. And we have always defined that or described that in literal terms as everybody on earth is dead, so he can't tempt anyone, which I still tend to agree with that. But now I'm seeing a consistency to this symbol of key as being directly related to the power of death, which would also tie back into Hebrews 2:14.
Well, when Jesus has the keys to death, he has the keys to open the graves and raise people to life. So it actually gets transformed to a symbol of life.
So is this a counterfeit of that? So he can open the grave and life comes out. When Satan uses keys to open the pit, death comes out.
And well, deception. He doesn't have the power. He doesn't have the power for life. He only has the power for death.
And that's all he wants.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he wants to do anyway.
Right.
Well, I think it's murder.
I was struck by verse 5 when we look at what this amalgamation does and they're impacting people that don't have the seals of God, but they're using their power over to torture, which is my understanding of regimes when they come in, that they always use torture to terrorize other individuals so that they will submit. Mm-hmm. And that is a key element in most, mm-hmm. you know, terrible, whether it's Nazi or Stalin or, you know, other tyrants, they always use torture as a way to intimidate and get people to do or else. And I just thought that was interesting that is such a satanic, use of power. And we see that on earthly realms. And it just reminded me of later people who deeply believe this and go along, they're sealed in there. You know, they have the mark of the beast in the forehead, but those who just go along to go along because they don't want to be taken out by someone who would threaten them with torture and death. Anyway, I thought that was.
Yeah.
Brad, what did you say? Because your internet cut out when you said it.
Oh, that's all right. I'm thinking back to the thought you mentioned earlier, the lies are like a smoke screen, the smoke. It's a deception. A lie smoke screen. And that is depicted, I guess, here by the locusts as well.
You just got cut out again.
Sorry. So we, our signal must not be strong enough, but yeah, no, it's not a huge point. I'm just seeing the bottomless pit is dark. What is else dark? Lies, Satan's deception, the smoke. It's a smoke screen. He may be trying to make it words of truth, but it's a smoke screen. He doesn't speak truth. It's his form. He doesn't, it's just like he can't give life, he can't speak truth. So it's all his distortion of truth, if you will, trying to masquerade as a truth teller.
Yeah. So are we ready to move on to... I like the idea of them being the limitations being set. Do we have anything more on verses 3, 4, and 5?
Yeah, we haven't really figured out what grass and trees are. Although we did discuss that earlier in the last trumpet, right?
Yeah, we did. I was thinking of Isaiah. All flesh is like grass. Grass is what. Doesn't Jesus say something about burning grass, like dried grass?
Yeah, how much more important you are than the flower of the field that today is there and tomorrow is cut and thrown into the oven.
Mm-hmm.
This clearly differentiates the grass and the tree and green things as not being part of those who don't have the seal of God.
Right. They're almost differentiated from people.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to say, what if this is the biosphere that God created? I mean, should I not have mercy on those who repent and the animals, you know, in Nineveh there? So God doesn't leave his creation out of this.
Yeah, that's a good point, because in the biosphere, we know the progression was there was no green thing or whatever until it was watered and until he had man to tend to it. So I like that thought, Mark.
I also thought that's what locusts do, though. They take on green things, but these locusts don't. They're unique in what locusts normally do. These guys are not doing. They're going after.
Yeah, they don't. They don't eat up. They flick torture,
mm-hmm.
because they're more like scorpions than they are locusts.
Right.
Or they're dual.
Another smoke screen.
Or they're dual application.
Yeah.
If they're dual application, they're attacking the vegetation and the people. The scorpions don't usually go after your vegetation. They like to, I don't know what they like to do.
They like to bed in wood. They love a wood pile.
But what do they do to it?
I don't know. I haven't learned what scorpions eat.
Yeah, you know, I've never... Scorpions have such terror to us.
They're insectivores.
All I know is that I had one in my house many years ago, and I took a fly swat, and I meant to hit it hard and kill it, and I actually lifted it up into the air, and it slammed against the wall, and it was dead. That's all
scorpions. They're insect predators.
They eat other insects.
I know very little about scorpions, but here in the desert, I don't leave my shoes on the ground, because I've heard people have left their shoes on the ground outside their RV, and then they stick their foot in, they get stung by a scorpion. So I did a tiny little bit of research, but they're predatory, and there are about 25 varieties that are venomous and can cause death to people, but they're predatory. So that was the main thing. I go, oh, that's interesting. It can be, that would fit with Satan. He's predatory.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Like a snake, their kill is in their venom as well in the tail.
Mm-hmm.
So the way they kill, especially wasps, which are one of their greatest opponents. I don't know if that's the right word. They will sting it multiple times.
Hmm.
And my understanding, I could be wrong, is after the wasp is dead, the scorpion will eat it. So I don't know what that means, but a lot of pain from what I understand. I know a few folks down in Texas who have to deal with that, and they say it's very, very painful. And yeah.
The couple of scorpions I've met along life's journey are not fearful. I remember being in Death Valley, just camping sleep bags on the ground, woke up in the morning, and there was one staring at me. And when I lifted up my sleep bag so he couldn't crawl in, charged. And he met a quick end. I'm much bigger, although he was pretty fast. I look at that, and the predatory thing comes to mind, I think is an accurate thing. But they're not fearful. They will just charge to their own destruction.
Mm. Interesting.
You sure wouldn't want to meet a whole cloud of those falling out of the sky now, would you?
No, I do think, though, that the illustration that what John sees is locusts, what he thinks is locusts, and they don't go after what they would normally do.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is what's truly profound, and instead they're going after what scorpions go after. So it is, he's doing his best to describe something highly unusual. And I think, to me, it's, there's something profound. Earlier we had a third of nature damaged, but in this case, that is not what is either permitted or what happens. Instead, they go after people who have rejected, if you will, the woo of God.
So something different. Could this be conveying, because we're still talking metaphors and symbology for spiritual realities here.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not talking religious realities, we're talking spiritual realities. To me, this discussion is starting to make me think that maybe this is alerting us to a sudden shift in strategy. Because when you said, they start out as locusts, and you expect locusts to go after the vegetation. But suddenly, they switch strategy. It's like bait and switch kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And they change what they have always been known to do. And suddenly, they do something you never expected them to do. So if throughout history, as someone described, well, they always use torture, they always use violence, they always use war to get their way. What if it comes around to our day and suddenly it's not open warfare? Suddenly it's not open torture. Suddenly they actually enlist the cooperation of their victims through deception, through enticements, through solicitation and of deceiving them to think they're doing it for their own good, and they all line up and support you to victimize them. That is craftiness at its height. Instead of a frontal attack, which is met with frontal resistance, you actually deceive them into participating in their own demise.
Interesting. What would be a logical...
I was thinking something along those lines, in that we have not considered the possibility that these are not imposed by all the things that we have set in motion come back to rest or come back to haunt us.
It goes to the giving of the key. So if those who are tortured have given that authority to the torturer,
mm-hmm.
it would make sense that it, I love the idea of the spiritual warfare. I wouldn't have used that language for the spiritual, yeah, spiritual warfare, in that it's a shifting of offense, and so or shifting of methodology. I'm still thinking about that one, but I see it as the willingness of the victims to fall prey to their own torture or inflict it on themselves through deception. I mean, in the Revelations context, it makes a lot of sense.
And especially,
isn't that?
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just thinking on that line. Isn't that what Satan does through distorting God's character, because he knows you become like the God you worship?
Yeah.
So he's already got it done. How many Christians go and sit and worship every week thinking that God's going to kill them or burn them or artificially keep them alive just, you know, because that's who he is? And they'll do it to other people too. It's just.
But I think that that's a very clear way to look at this, because the picture of God that many people have is of a God who will torture you forever and ever. Exactly. If you don't obey him, if you don't worship him.
And the torment, if we take it and believe on the fact that he's a merciful, loving God, the torment is only given to him for 5 months. So it's a very, very quick, if you will, stinging period. And the sting, the worst sting can be, is when you come to a realization that what you've decided or where you've been walking or how you've carried yourself or how you treat somebody is contrary to adding to that life-giving force that we need to have, comes back and you look and say, wow, I had an understanding, but now I don't. And now that torment that comes on you could be internalized quite a bit, because it's just that they're running around looking to die. What, you know, what could be worse than
they want to look die. At?
Yeah. Yeah. What could be look worse than once the smoke in front of the mirror that we're supposed to reflect dissipates and we look at ourselves in that torment saying, I gave up my choice to be with God. How did I do that?
Now, I have to still say, given this trumpet, it still sounds like there's the ability for people to come to a realization they've chosen poorly and to change their mind. I think there's other illustrations that reveal the refusal to change the mind. I don't know. That's just me.
I don't know about that probational period, but does that mean that's off the table now?
Well, the plagues indicate in chapter 16 that's the point of no return.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe this is a sort of the squeezing out for almost the last time of everything you can possibly get out to extract out of those who are choosing to be lost and trying to turn the stragglers back. I see this pattern. This is really helping me see this a lot better. I also see this two-stage bait and switch kind of thing tied to those two things I pointed out earlier. I'm starting to see a connection, because the first, where the key is given, involves the deception. That's almost exclusively the deceptive part of this. And so if you're willing to be deceived and you go along with the deception, you have given them the key. The next thing that comes after you are cooperating with the deception is then the torture. So the torture is after they have power, and the power is received when you bought into the lie and gave them a key. I see it as a two-stage thing here.
And wouldn't the torture also be a metaphor or the opposite part of being sealed in our foreheads? That's where our mind is, symbolic of our mind, the forehead. So you're either settled into who God is, mm-hmm. or you're tortured by the idea that you don't know him.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the tortured with the idea that God is a torturer.
Yes.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking, I can hear it in my head that there's an idea of the torture being overly self-inflicted within my mind about me, as opposed to being tortured in my mind about God or mm-hmm. of my alignment to a deception. Because I guess I can see, even for myself, when I come up to a self-realization, which side do I want to go towards for review, for correction? I want to go to the God who's trustworthy to be gentle and teach me through love for restoration than a stern taskmaster that only wants to further destroy who I am. So I guess in all of the internal conflicts we end up with, I don't necessarily see those internal conflicts ending, but which side do we go to for correction, for teaching, and for learning? And to me, the saints, the sealed, will always fall towards a true picture of God as restorative, and the rebels aligned with the adversary will choose the deception, the false picture. And I think that has a level of added torment that we have yet to really describe or experience overall. Oh, does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well said.
I think there's also another aspect of torture. When we go the adversary's way, it always leads to pain, misery, and sorrow, and our life becomes torture.
Mm-hmm.
And
our life or light?
Our life becomes
life. Thank you.
What you're stating, though, is kind of along the lines like the thought I had when you were saying that, Bill, is, okay, I'm in a room. There's many of these mirrors, and they're all being turned, you know, that the typical circus room, you know, with the mirrors. And that, you know, and we heard this expression, smoke and mirrors, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So once that smoke dissipates, what you're saying is, which I appreciate now because it's encouraging, which mirror am I looking, what am I reflecting? You know, a mirror doesn't, you know what I mean? It's
mirrors can lie. Right?
Comment more on that. I mean, when we're, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't want to go into that mirror on the wall thing, but it is kind of a description of what we're reflecting and where we're at in that reflection is, are we reflecting the right image or not?
Yeah.
And this can be more than just Satan's direct lies. It can be generational.
Right.
I've watched adults who abuse people. When you get to the bottom of where that abuse comes from, it comes from having been abused as children by their parents or by significant people in their lives. And I just think how Satan has just done chapter 9 to the whole human race.
Correct.
In a sense.
Exactly.
The good news is that studies show, at least one study shows that in case of pedophilia, that there is a change at the third or fourth generation. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
The third or fourth generation, there's a change. And the third or fourth generation decides not to continue the sins of their fathers.
That is like some serious fruit on the top branch, way out there on the tip, sister. But thanks for sharing it. They also say in psychopaths, if you ask anyone of these mass murderers, killers, they ask neighbors, they did an inventory on them, they ask them, what kind of person was it? And 75% of them say, well, he was a nice person. He was a very, very nice person. So this smoke and mirrors is very, very difficult. I learned something yesterday in reading a gentleman's take on Ephesians 4 is that our heart has to be able to accept even pedophiles. We can't judge them at all.
Well, there's actually a former pedophile who has been fairly successful in dealing in doing group ministries with other pedophiles and helping them to heal. And he uses methods that we would respond to as restorative.
That's some lower-lying fruit. I appreciate that.
So, but this is the point for me is that no matter for the sociopath, the psychopath, whatever, before the pattern is truly broken and freedom is fully restored, the idea that a person within that having some acknowledgement of an issue or problem, even helpless as they may still have a connection that they choose to fall on God, the true picture of God, whatever that is for them, God knows, as opposed to, and I think the confusion of end times and what may be happening versus history and whatever we may be going through. And I only remember, recall in Luke and the other places, don't judge. Mm-hmm. I like the reminder that we are called to love. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean we don't have boundaries. We don't, not everyone is safe in society or in our circles. But how do we come to even those who are being tortured in this trumpet? It seems like the saints are still to love.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not being discussed, but
the thing is that regardless of how we have to maintain boundaries, we still have to love them in our attitude.
Correct.
Absolutely. And Jesus demonstrated that over and over. Name me one person he didn't love always. They don't
exist. Right. He called Judas a friend.
Would we apply to this the observation? I think this is from Graham, but not everybody who died in the flood was lost. Just because you didn't die because you were lost, you died because you didn't get on the ark. Would we apply that here too to say that there's actually three categories of people? There's the saints, the elect few who really get it. There's the confirmed rebels who also get it. Yeah. My understanding is that the rebels know who God is and just don't like it. And then there's a whole bunch of others who just didn't get on the ark. Would that apply here at the end as well?
It's an interesting concept because I think quite a bit when I hear about prayers about Ukraine and Russia. I think it's like what Floyd is saying. This is a progression. This is an overlapping. This is people coming to understand the true heart. A rediscovering God is the way I would put it.
I like that. I like that one.
You're breaking up, Brad.
Not only do we rediscover God, in the process of discovering God, do we also discover who we are as his image bearers? And is that not a torment to those who have rejected him?
Yeah, I was thinking when we were talking about the torment, I wasn't sure if it applied, but my understanding of why sin doesn't immediately kill all of us is that God is protecting us from the consequences of our choices, and that what happens at the end is that protection starts to be withdrawn. To me, the piece of information that I think would torment me most is if I really understood all the things that I'd done, all the harm that I'd caused to myself and everybody else, if I couldn't hide from that anymore without some confidence that God's got my back and God's going to work this out, that would be the ultimate torture to me, to not be able to hide from everything that I've done and who I have become and how out of tune I have become with the universe as it really is.
And that would manifest an increasing amount of unkindness, a lack of compassion in every action. And to me, that's far more. So I don't know, Brad, it's not torment. If I'm a rebel, it's not torment that I'm no longer reflecting this love because I've rejected it. It's the fact that unmediated, because I've cut myself off from reconciliation, right? Not to the Father, but to myself, from the desire to love. Now I become increasingly motivated to control others, to abuse others, to hurt.
Violence.
Yeah, yep. The scapegoating mechanism moving into full swing.
Yep.
I mean, that's why they went after Jesus so much, and why they quite, the followers of Satan will go after anybody who holds up a mirror to them to say, this is who you really are. And that was to me, the thing that Jesus did was the way he lived, the way he treated people, his life held up a mirror that said, wow, you know, and they couldn't stand to see it, and they had to get rid of him. Mm-hmm. And I think we see that at the end too, that they can't stand to know who they really are and what they've become.
Mm. And in this case, I'm not sure how cognitive it is, but there's no longer the they've cut the woo off of God. And I think they're just being let go to become worse and worse, because that's the natural flow of disconnection.
Well, it isn't just the natural flow, that what Mark said about them just not liking that mirror.
Yeah.
They get really proactive about rejection.
Yeah.
And the hardness of heart against the truth repeatedly.
Yeah.
Well, it's painful, and you're going to, the reaction to pain is first fear, then anger, and if you're in that mode, then violence. That's a very quick progression.
Or anger, depression, shame, blame. These are all these tenets, but it's interesting because I was thinking what Gene said in verse 7. I'm kind of trying to get ahead a little bit here. And the shapes of the locusts were like horses, and you brought that up earlier, but it's still that Babylonian, kind of like that Phoenix rising thing. I've been thinking about this whole call,
Babylonian mixtures.
What is going on here? You know, what is this like? What do they call it? The mixing, you know, where you have CRISPR.
Technology. Their faces are like human faces. That's a quintessential, prototype of Babylonian.
And, you know, that's probably going to take us another conversation to get to that one. For sure.
What John could be saying, and I don't know if John had enough of a Babylonian background to say this, but this could be what God is saying through the text, is that not even the protective spirits are other than terrible, torturing you. Mm. So not even the protective spirits can protect you because they've turned traitor.
Mm.
Yeah, I look at the clustering here, and I think 7 to 11 would take up a whole week's discussion.
Well, I think we probably better pull it to a close then, unless there's something else in the verses before that.
We have a hand up, Nancy.
I just think it's fascinating to look at how Satan treats those that are already his. You know, these are people who don't. God, and I just go, they're on your side. Why would you treat them like this? It's just fascinating to me. We hear little snippets sometimes of stories where people are channeler, you know, recognize, hey, I'll be a channeler. You can channel through me and I'll produce this work. And then how Satan destroys their lives. It's just, you know, this book is so revealing, not only about who God is, but who Satan ultimately is.
Yeah. He uses people as long as he can, and then when he's done with them, he throws them away.
So I have a question. I forgot the name of the lady that's with you, Bill.
Oh, Vanetta.
I'm dying of curiosity because you are highly objective. I don't think you've ever been exposed to this before, and I'm so interested to get your reaction to your first exposure to this.
To this group of
crazy thinkers.
Yeah, super, super interesting. You have given me good reminders, thanks to Chuan, and just like recognizing the great controversy that is always going on and constantly going on, and reminding of God's true character and even Satan's true character. Satan's the one who destroys, kills, and steals. And God is the one who heals, redeems, and restores.
Mm-hmm. Well said.
That was a great synopsis of the scene.
Nice summary. Yeah.
You got all of that from this call? I'm thankful that you shared that with me, and it lifts me up. Thank you very much. And please know, if we need to come back and return and regroup, we'd be happy to have you.
Thank you.
All right. Do you want to stop here? Is there anything left over that we need to discuss before we wrap up?
So what verse did we end on? 9?
Well, that's a good question. We didn't really do, I looked at, I think 7 to 11 is the last chunk of this trumpet that hasn't been processed.
I think we should start with 7.
Yeah.
Start with verse 7.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Somebody write that down.
Okay. I've circled it for next week. Okay. We'll begin with verse 7.
We're reading Revelations, and y'all are telling me you can't remember the number 7.
If it, nothing else,
has not to do with the number 7; it has to do with the verse.
Oh, okay. Sorry. Thank you for the clarification.
If nothing else,
I was in my Babylonian mind. Sorry.
It's the label of 7 to 11.
All right. Let's have prayer. Gracious God, we thank you so much for enlightening us, for being with us this afternoon and evening as we continue to make incremental progress through this book that is so fascinating. We ask that you will enlighten us during the week on things that we need for next week's study, as well as helping us to apply what we've learned today. We ask that your spirit be with us this week as well as he has today. In Jesus' name, amen.